Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities with Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. President Donald Trump's Justice Department has indicted New York Attorney General Letitia James for mortgage fraud. As WNYC's Jimmy Vielkind reports, the charges are the latest case against one of Trump's adversaries.
Federal prosecutors say the Democratic Attorney General made false claims on a mortgage application for a house she bought in Norfolk, Virginia. A three-count indictment says James saved almost $20,000 on her mortgage by stating it would be a second residence, not an investment property. James says the charges are politically motivated. She's been in Trump's crosshairs since she won a 2023 civil fraud case against the president.
These charges are baseless, and the president's own public statements make clear that his only goal is political retribution at any cost.
Trump says James led a witch hunt against him. He's publicly pushed prosecutors to bring charges and called for James to resign. In Albany, I'm Jimmy Vielkind for the New York Public News Network.
New York State Governor Kathy Hochul held a press conference this week calling out the federal government for denying the Metropolitan Transit Authority a security grant aimed at funding counterterrorism. The Legislative Gazette's Sagina Shrestha has more.
The MTA was slotted to receive $34 million from the federal government through the Transit Security Grant Program. According to Hochul's office, that money has been rescinded, making New York State the only state that was denied this funding. The money from the program was supposed to fund safety measures in public transit. Measures included deployment of multiple counterterrorism teams, TSA-mandated training for MTA employees, and a cyber lab that would vet technology systems. Hochul says the state is being targeted because it elects Democrats.
There's no other explanation. Look at the states that they continue the funding for these projects. Are they more at risk of a terrorism attack? Texas, Florida, Nevada, give me a break. This is New York. We need the support. We're demanding that it start being unleashed immediately.
The Transit Security Grant Program was started after 9/11 and funds grants that help keep public transit safe. I'm Sagina Shrestha.
Advocates visited the state capitol in Albany this week to urge Governor Kathy Hochul to sign the Medical Aid in Dying Act into law. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas was there.
The activists presented the governor's office with a letter signed by more than 4,200 supporters across the state imploring Hochul to take action now. The New York Medical Aid in Dying Act was passed this year by both chambers of the New York State Legislature. It allows health care providers to prescribe self-administered life-ending medication to qualified patients with terminal illnesses. Corinne Carey, Compassion and Choices, Senior Campaign Director for New York and New Jersey, emphasizes the urgency for the terminally ill.
They want the peace of mind of knowing that they have the option of a peaceful death. The governor's signature would give them that.
Under the measure, an individual must be over 18, have a serious life-limiting illness with a prognosis of 6 months or less to live, and be mentally competent. If signed into law, New York would join 11 states and the District of Columbia with similar death with dignity laws.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustino. This week, I sat down with David Lombardo, host of the Capitol Press Room on WCNY, to talk about the federal cuts and the impact on New York State counties.
Sure. We had the Oswego County Administrator, Phil Church, who now serves, as you mentioned, as president of the New York State Association of Counties on the show, to talk about how counties are going to have increased obligations as a result of the what's called One Big Beautiful Bill down in D.C. As it pertains to the administration of SNAP benefits as well as Medicaid. And In light of the additional responsibilities they're going to have and some cuts to their funding, they're looking to the state to backfill that support. And they're just one of many stakeholders who are going to be clamoring for funding in 2026 as the result of federal changes. And it remains to be seen who is going to be able to get an additional piece of the pie from the state, because everybody's going to want something and the state has its own problems. So it remains to be seen which stakeholders are going to have significant sway and whether any of this has political repercussions for the congressional Republicans and President Donald Trump, who moved this bill back in July.
Yeah, I mean, David, the cuts don't discriminate between a blue district or a red district.
Yeah, they do, though, disproportionately hit blue states based on some of the policies that they have embraced. So New York, you often hear about the people who are going to have their government-provided health care services or even their government-subsidized health care services impacted. In large part, the number of people that's infected in New York is a product of New York policies and policies that, say, red states maybe haven't actually taken. So some of this is targeted to a certain degree, but things like SNAP benefits, that's something that is, as you said, impacting people whether you live in a red district, a blue district, or purple district.
David Lombardo, and then there's the arguments that are being made from the state Republicans. You know, I'll pick one, Republican Minority Leader Will Barclay, who I talked to. You know, they are parroting the congressional line, which is basically when I ask them about cuts to SNAP and Medicaid and things, it's, well, on SNAP, you know, we're dealing with fraud. This has nothing to do with kicking legitimate people off. We're only kicking off the people that don't deserve it. Is that fair?
Well, fair. It's probably a good talking point, but I would say maybe it's a little disingenuous. If you look at some of the, say, work requirements on Medicaid,
right,
and some of the new requirements on SNAP as well, they sound great in practice, but in reality, they are largely just a additional layer of paperwork that can be too much of a burden for people. And so we hear from these nonprofits who are trying to ramp up their efforts to help people navigate this process. And Republicans are all for, you know, feeding people and all for certain programs. And then when they're, you know, on the outside looking in, they find reasons why, you know, we're spending too much. But when they're put in a decision-making position, they're not making cuts. I mean, we saw in New York for decades, Republicans ran the state Senate. They held the executive mansion, and there were not cuts to these programs. There were not demonstrable changes to the administration of these programs. So I think what we sometimes hear from people who are out of power, like Assembly Minority Leader Barclay, are the kind of rhetoric that sounds great, but in practice is not how policymakers in the majority choose to govern.
Well, there's that other statement that you made. Maybe we could go into just a little bit more, because I think people are ready to disqualify it immediately. Well, what do you mean there's too much paperwork? Well, first of all, when it comes to the Republican side, they're often talking about the burden of too much paperwork for small businesses. So now let's look at the human beings at the bottom of the economic scale. Why would it be so difficult?
So maybe to you and me, it doesn't necessarily seem
right,
like it's a problem. But I don't know about you. I don't actually have to fill out any paperwork in my day-to-day life. And when I do, I complain about it, whether it's, you know, getting my health insurance forms re-upped at the end of the year or just having to go to the doctor's office.
And you have command of the language.
I do. I have command of the language. I have a college degree from a fine SUNY institution. And that's not a problem for me. But for other people, whether it is an issue with language, whether it is an issue with maybe I only worked 19 hours this week, but I'm going to work 25 the next week, or I'm a seasonal employee, or I'm a cash employee. There are all sorts of challenges that people have to navigate. And I'm not saying that there is not fraud. I'm not saying there isn't abuse. I'm not saying there isn't waste. But what we hear from nonprofits and we hear from people who live and breathe this is that the fraction of people that you might catch and get off programs does not make up for the vast majority of the people who should be receiving these programs, who, you know, these are designed to help. And ultimately, if you're kicking them off, you're going to have more deleterious effects down the road than, you know, any sort of short-term savings.
Yeah, I appreciate that explanation, because we often get pushback when we bring that up. But it is significant The other part that I'd like to bring up now when it comes to money in New York is the fact that Governor Hochul has spent a great deal of time on an affordability agenda. And one of the things is she's giving these checks back to New Yorkers, $400. And, you know, while right now, if you talk to the state comptroller, now's budgeting isn't the problem. It's out-year budgets that are going to be in the billions in the hole. And it makes you kind of turn around and say, is this the kind of thing we should be doing with state funding in light of what's coming?
Well, you know how they say people can't really agree on anything in politics anymore?
Sure.
This is one of those great issues that has united, say, economists on the left side of the aisle and the right side of the aisle. And they're united in the fact that they don't like this policy.
That's right.
And this was originally conceived as a $3 billion proposal from the governor. It was eventually tapered down to $2 billion. It's worth $200 for New Yorkers who made $75,000 or less, and for $400 for families that made $150,000 or less. And there's, you know, a sliding scale for other amounts if you go above that. But what we recently had, you know, our public media colleague Jimmy Vielkind was highlighting was the fact that you might get a check for $200 if you're an individual. Well, maybe put aside $20 to $30 of that because you're going to have to pay taxes.
Yeah, federal taxes.
On it, which means that a $2 billion program is going to include at least $200 million heading down south to Washington, D.C., which is another knock against this program. And this idea that, you know, I qualify for this check and I am going to cash the check. I'm going to spend the check. Thank you very much for the check. I don't need the check.
We don't need the check.
And there are a lot of people.
And she didn't need to get it so that it was taxed on the federal level. Am I right about that?
So if she wanted to distribute a check like this, it probably had to have a tax. If the governor wanted to just put money in people's pockets, they could have done other things. They could have done a tax credit. It just wouldn't have happened as fast.
That's David Lombardo, host of the Capitol Press Room on WCNY. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The Adirondack Park Agency is pushing forward with plans to move its office to Saranac Lake. The agency says a new downtown headquarters would allow growth and increase transparency, but some critics say it's unnecessary and are urging the agency to reconsider. The New York Public News Network's Emily Russell has the story.
The Adirondack Park Agency is housed in an old brown building in Raybrook, halfway between Lake Placid and Saranac Lake. It was originally just a log building, first used by the state troopers in the 1960s. Then the DEC took it over for a few years. Finally, the APA moved in.
As with all things with APA, really, we get the hand-me-down.
APA Communications Director Keith McKeever shared some history of the headquarters at the September board meeting.
And when the agency was created in 71, they lifted up the central structure and moved it over here.
That original log structure was renovated and added on to four times in recent decades. Today, the APA says the building has big problems. An engineering and design firm found that the logs, siding, and roofing on the oldest parts of the building were at or near the end of their lives. The firm suggested upgrades that were estimated to cost up to $2.4 million. Terry Martino was the APA's executive director at the time. In a memo, she said upgrading the headquarters in Raybrook would be like, quote, adding a bandage to a structure that is beyond its useful life. McKeever told the APA board last month, it's time to move on.
You know, for 50 plus years now, we've been in this hodgepodge building doing really great work. And it's definitely an opportunity for us to get a new office building that will suit our needs and be designed so it'll be able to accommodate growth going forward.
The state has budgeted $40 million for a new APA headquarters. The preferred site is in downtown Saranac Lake at 1 and 3 Main Street. The plan would be to renovate the historic Paul Smith's Electric Power and Light building and put up another bigger office building in the vacant lot behind it.
The site checks off a lot of boxes for the APA. You know, we have infill development, we're in the hamlet location, we're closer to the majority of APA staff, which gives us the opportunity for people to have different modes of transportation to work.
But not everyone has gotten behind the move. A survey obtained by the Adirondack Explorer 2 years ago found that more than half of all APA staff didn't want to move to Saranac Lake. That same year, 19 former staff and board members signed a letter also opposing the move. The letter suggested that rehabbing the Raybrook office would be a lot cheaper and questioned why the APA hadn't done a full feasibility study on staying put. James Connolly signed that letter. He was the APA's deputy director of planning for more than a decade. Connolly retired in 2013, and at last month's meeting, he urged the APA board to question the move.
All I'm asking today is that you do due diligence and start asking why. What benefit is there to the agency of such a move? It's virtually none.
But the APA is arguing the opposite. They say renovating the current building would disrupt and displace workers for months, if not longer. They say a new building would be a better, safer work environment. And they say it's not just about the APA, that moving to an Adirondack hub would reflect the agency's commitments to the park's communities. The APA says it does plan to host a community forum in Saranac Lake later this year. Meanwhile, it's working with the village and the state on securing a lease. In Raybrook, I'm Emily Russell for the New York Public News Network.
Well, in Saratoga County, this summer horse racing meet attracts thousands of tourists. But as the Legislative Gazette's Aaron Shella-Levine reports, come the fall, there are still plenty of visitors flocking to the area.
There are only a few weeks between the Labor Day close of the summer meet at Saratoga Racecourse and what local historians dub victory season at Saratoga National Historical Park. Just days before October begins, reenactors are camping out across the park's 10-mile Battlefield Tour Road loop.
We've had big crowds all weekend. They've been very engaged in conversations. I think people are starting to realize a little bit more about the American Revolution and how important it was and what a key point not only Saratoga but this whole region is.
Sean Kelleher is the town of Saratoga's historian and part of a series of reenactments leading up to the October 12th siege weekend at the park.
The fall season, of course, is wonderful in part because we have these beautiful leaves turning, and at the same time, we have one of the most important military campaigns that happen in world history, never mind American history, happen at the same exact time. So you can kind of overlay those two experiences.
The Battle of Saratoga in 1777 was the so-called turning point of the American Revolution. The defeat of the British Army would convince France to join the American fight for independence. Nearly 250 years later, the history of the tide-turning effort is still celebrated with a number of reenactments culminating with Surrender Day at Fort Hardy Park on October 17th. Saratoga County historian Lauren Roberts says reenactments are a great way for locals and tourists to experience the revolutionary history that happened right under their feet more than two centuries ago.
You know, we're lucky enough that we have some really dedicated reenactors that do a good job researching and wearing very accurate uniforms, and they love talking to the public. They, you know, this is a passion for them, but I think when they see the understanding that comes from reenactors conversing, you know, you can ask those interactive questions. Not only do they give you a verbal answer, but you can actually see what they're cooking over the fire. They'll show you what weapons they had. They'll explain to you how they made their uniforms and why they're the color they are.
Garrett Clower is the program manager for interpretation and visitor experience at Saratoga National Historical Park. He says the benefits of historical programming at the park go beyond just education.
You know, obviously the reason that Saratoga National Historical Park exists is to preserve the battlefield and the stories, right? But those stories draw people, and people, of course, when they come here, they bring money. So we're really excited to be able to contribute to the local economy, and we're happy that our visitors are able to bring so many benefits.
New data from the National Park Service show parks in New York generated $877 million in 2024, with more than half of that being spent on lodging and restaurants. In Saratoga County, more than 116,000 visitors to Saratoga National Historical Park spent $8.2 million in surrounding communities. Saratoga County Chamber of Commerce President Todd Shimkus says as the 250th anniversary of the American Revolution approaches, the economic impact of historical tourism will only grow.
The understanding is that we have a very strong summer season. We just had probably the best summer season we've ever had in Saratoga County. And yet you can't count on just the summer. We have to have those other seasons like the fall that also are spectacular and drive visitors here and people who want to stay in our hotels, spend money in our restaurants, shop in our stores, visit our historical sites and see, the turning point of the American Revolution.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Aaron Shallow Levine.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The historic Oakwood Cemetery in Troy, New York, is celebrating its 175th anniversary next week, but there's more to the rural cemetery than its gorgeous rooms and towering tombstones. As the Legislative Gazette's Samantha Simmons reports, there's a story behind the stones.
That little pumpkin is in the flag over there, that's my mother and father's right there. So they are also...
Are you going on this side too near them or no?
We are back where you can actually have vertical stones.
Heidi Klonowski will be buried in the historic cemetery with a plot pick near the chapel. So if there's an afterlife, she'll still know what's going on, she says. She joined the Friends of Oakwood Cemetery, a group of volunteers who promote and support the cemetery, in the late 1990s. Now in her 80s, she walked the park with her family and friends as a kid and is the go-to for all things history and tours for Oakwood. Klonowski and I drove around the nearly 12 miles of existing roads and pathways to take in the sights, sounds, and beauty of the final resting place of upwards of 60,000 people. She gave me the lowdown on the history of some of the people who are buried here. She says she has generations of ancestors buried here, not all of whom she knew or knew was buried here until she joined the Friends group. During our tour, we ran into another friend of the cemetery, Donna Guzzi, who told us this.
And Elmore is down here. His mother changed his name. So he was Elmore. And there's another one, Griffin, that's buried up here somewhere. I haven't found him yet.
There's a Donald McDonald someplace too, I remember seeing.
While out enjoying the serenity of the paved and gravel roads, Klonowski says it's the names, dates, and architecture that catch her eye. On a gravel road deep in the landscape, she uncovered a stone overgrown with grass. The stone bore the surname Billings, which drew her in because of a familial relation. Carrie Billings was 8 years old when she died. Her parents sold marble from a store they owned in the city's downtown. Her parents had gone to Vermont to buy more marble and left her with her grandmother and uncle in Wineskill.
He was 19 years old. He was going hunting, and he had a rifle in his hand. And the newspaper article, I mean, they gave every detail in those times, which is amazing. They said she was dancing around in front of him and said, "Can I go with you, please? Can I go with you to go hunting?" And he said, "No, you can't. Be careful, Carrie. The gun might go off." And just as he said that, the gun went off and it hit her in the face and killed her. Mm. And I'm like, oh my God, would you ever think by finding a little tiny bit of a stone here that there would be a horrible, or any kind of story like that behind it? Well, continuing further a couple days later in the newspaper was a whole thing about her funeral, how they had this purple velvet-lined casket and silver lift rings on the sides and a silver plate with her name on it.
The graveyard was founded in 1850 following a discussion with six prominent city men who thought the area needed a rural, non-denominational cemetery. Albany Rural Cemetery had been founded about half a dozen years before, and the men said the eastern side of the river needed one too. Kathy Sheehan, the City of Troy and Rensselaer County's historian, says it rose to prominence because it was built at just the right time.
You just had such a different... It's a different change in how we thought about death and dying, is that really going away from that very kind of Puritan standard where you knew which was going to happen. You're either going to go to heaven or you're going to go. And we were really starting to embrace nature as a theme. It shows up in not only paintings, but furniture and everything. And this rural cemetery movement follows suit with all that.
Sheehan projects the cemetery has enough space to bury people for the next 100 years. Sheehan, a Troy native who also plans to be buried here, emphasizing, though, that there's no rush, says people use the wooded and waterfall-filled Greenland for recreation, too. A train would take visitors to 101st Street, where they could access the cemetery, or take carriage rides to their family stones for picnics. But now, there's walking tours, runners, and more who take a gander at the tombstones when they pass by.
During COVID, it exploded. People felt, you know, you wanted to be outside, you wanted to have someplace safe. The beautiful part of Oakwood is it has these amazing meandering trails, and you can be by yourself. And if somebody's coming down, well, you just move off into another little trail and a little roadway and things like that. And so it really became a safe haven for myself included.
Clint Anglin and Naomi Jaffe have been walking in the cemetery for 30 years. They live nearby and are fascinated by the wildlife that roam the grounds.
Well, there's
the habitat is
it's like a wildlife refuge. Yeah, there's so many. There's foxes and all kinds of
great
things,
variety of animal and bird life.
And also, it's quiet. There's no traffic to speak of.
Among the historic architecture are the burial grounds of Civil War generals, several RPI presidents, Emma Willard, and most famously Uncle Sam and his wife Betsy and their three children. Also of note, past and present board members, the late state senator Joe Bruno, and founders of the cemetery and their families. Work continues daily by a grounds crew, volunteers, the cemetery administrator, and the head grounds superintendent, who both live in the cemetery. Celebrations marking the cemetery's 175th anniversary begin on October 16th, with a fundraising gala in the Earl Memorial Chapel and Crematorium, which is home to the so-called Gorgeous Room with its stained glass panels and high ceilings, followed by a Victorian tea and lawn party on the 18th, and tours starting at noon on the 19th. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Samantha Simmons.
Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.